public. In baseball, before you sign a player, you can look up his batting average, home runs, and steals, assess his strengths and weaknesses, and adjust accordingly. Dalio wanted Bridgewater to work the same way, so he created baseball cards that display statistics on every employee's performance, which can be accessed by anyone at the company. If you're about to interact with a few Bridgewater colleagues for the first time, you can see their track records on 77 different dimensions of values, skills, and abilities in the areas of higher-level thinking, practical thinking, maintaining high standards, determination, open-mindedness yet assertiveness, and organization and reliability. During regular review cycles, employees rate one another on different qualities like integrity, courage, living in truth, taking the bull by its horns, not tolerating problems, being willing to touch a nerve, fighting to get in sync, and holding people accountable. Between cycles, employees can give real-time open feedback to anyone in the company. At any time, employees can submit dots or observations. They assess peers, leaders, or subordinates on the metrics and give short explanations of what they've observed. The baseball cards create a point list picture of staff members, aggregating across review cycles and dots, and incorporate various assessments that employees take. The cards display changes over time, revealing who's best suited to play each position, and flagging areas to rely on and watch out for with green and red lights. When you express an opinion, it's weighted by whether you've established yourself as believable on that dimension. Your believability is a probability of being right in the present and is based on your judgment, reasoning, and behavior in the past. In presenting your views, you're expected to consider your own believability by telling your audience how confident you are. If you have doubts and you're not known as believable in the domain, you shouldn't have an opinion in the first place. You're supposed to ask questions so you can learn. If you're expressing a fierce conviction, you should be forthright about it, but know that your colleagues will probe the quality of your reasoning. Even then, you're supposed to be assertive and open-minded at the same time. As management scholar Carl Weick advises, argue like you're right and listen like you're wrong. When principles collide. What happens, though, when believable people don't agree? In the summer of 2014, Bridgewater conducted an anonymous survey to find out about dissent that hadn't been voiced. When co-CEO Greg Jensen led an all-hands meeting to discuss the results, an employee, Ashley, commented that some people were misinterpreting Bridgewater's principles. Greg asked if she was correcting them when that occurred, and Ashley mentioned that she had recently called someone out for a misinterpretation. By speaking up, Ashley was exemplifying one of Bridgewater's principles. But rather than responding to the substance of her comment, Greg called her out for violating another Bridgewater principle, which emphasizes the importance of understanding the difference between the forest and the trees and navigating between the two. He wanted a synthesis of how she handled such situations in general, not her account of a specific case. A senior manager, Trina Soski, felt that Greg made a bad leadership decision. Although he was attempting to adhere to one Bridgewater principle, Trina was concerned that Ashley and others might be discouraged from speaking up in the future. In most organizations, since Greg had higher status than her, a manager in Trina's position would remain silent and go home thinking he was a jerk. But Trina wrote honest feedback for the whole company to read. She praised Ashley for having the courage and integrity to speak up, and cautioned Greg that his response signaled the exact opposite of what you, as a CEO, should model. In a typical organization, as the senior leader, Greg's opinion would prevail over Trina's, and her career might be in jeopardy for criticizing him. But at Bridgewater, Trina wasn't punished, and the resolution wasn't based on authority, seniority, majority, or who spoke the most loudly or forcefully. It started with a debate via email. Greg disagreed with Trina's views, as he felt he was being open and direct. After all, Principle 3 stated that no one has the right to hold a critical opinion without speaking up. But Trina had heard two different people criticize Greg's behavior in informal conversations. The dampening impact is going to be more about what you don't see and don't hear, she wrote to him. She worried that Greg's behavior would instigate groupthink, causing people to stay silent rather than to challenge leaders. Greg stood his ground. By allowing people to talk behind his back, Trina was failing to hold people accountable for confronting him with their critical opinions. She was allowing them to violate one of Bridgewater's principles by acting like slimy weasels. It's extremely rare to see a senior leader open to this kind of thoughtful disagreement, but even more unusual was what Greg did next. "I doubt we'll be able to resolve this ourselves," he wrote to Trina, copying the entire management committee, a group of people who had established their believability as leaders. "It's like agreeing on a judge or a mediator," Dalio explains. By escalating the disagreement to them, Greg was allowing the idea meritocracy to sort out who was right. Instead of leaving it to the management committee to resolve, though, Dalio asked Greg and Trina to collaborate on turning their conflict into a case to share with all of Bridgewater. Along with making their debate transparent, it forced them to inquire about each other's perspectives instead of just advocating for their own viewpoints. When the case was finished, to continue the inquiry process, Greg and Trina each generated questions to ask the entire company. Several months after the issue first occurred, it was still being discussed, and the analytics team was preparing to share the data on employees' reactions. But resolving the issue itself is in some ways less important than understanding the path to resolving such things in the future and agreeing on that, Zach Weider explains. No one, including our CEO, has any monopoly on the truth. I can't help but wonder, if Polaroid leaders had called people slimy weasels for talking behind Edwin Land's back about the problems with his instant movie camera, would the company still be thriving today? Had NASA's culture allowed for this kind of open disagreement, would the seven Columbia astronauts still be alive? Even if your organization doesn't currently embrace critical upward feedback, holding an open season on leaders might be an effective way to begin changing the culture. At the software company Index Group, CEO Tom Garrity asked a consultant to tell him everything he did wrong in front of his entire staff of roughly 100 employees. By role modeling receptivity to feedback, employees across the company became more willing to challenge him and one another. "I've learned to do something similar in the classroom. I collect anonymous feedback from students after the first month, focusing on constructive criticism and suggestions for improvement, and then email the full set of verbatim comments to the entire class. In the next class session, I summarize what I thought were the key suggestions, seek feedback on my interpretations, and propose changes to address these issues. Students often report that this dialogue makes them feel more comfortable in becoming active contributors to improving the class." It's not just Dalio's openness that makes people comfortable challenging senior leaders. It's the fact that early in the training, employees are encouraged to question the principals. Rather than waiting for employees to become experienced, Bridgewater reveals that we can start encouraging originality on day one. In most organizations, the socialization period is passive. We're busy learning the ropes and familiarizing ourselves with the culture. By the time we're up to speed, we're already swamped with work and beginning to see the world in the company way. The early period is the perfect time for employees to pay attention to to opportunities to improve the culture. A few years ago, I was hired by Goldman Sachs to identify steps for attracting and retaining talented investment banking analysts and associates by allowing them to improve the work environment. One of the initiatives that we introduced was an entry interview. Instead of waiting to ask employees for ideas on their way out, managers hold meetings to learn about new hires' ideas when they first join the organization. It's easier to start a relationship with the door open than to pry open a door that's already been slammed shut. The moment of truth. I was eager to find out for myself if Ray Dalio was anything like Edwin Land. Was he too attached to his own blueprint? How did he handle challenges to his principles? I had done enough inquiry at Bridgewater to develop some critical opinions of my own. By virtue of unearthing devil's advocates and conducting a thorough inquiry process before moving into advocacy, the company was unusually good at preventing groupthink. But that didn't mean they were perfect. Soon enough, I found myself sitting with Dalio at the kitchen table in his apartment. In the past, I would have hesitated to speak my mind. I've never enjoyed conflict, but my time studying Bridgewater had begun to change me. I'd become more direct in giving critical feedback, and who better to challenge than the forefather of radical transparency? I'd come to believe that no one had the right to hold a critical opinion without speaking up about it, I explained to Dalio. And since that's what their culture prizes, I wouldn't pull any punches. I'm unoffendable, he replied, giving me the green light to go ahead. If I were running the show, I began, Bridgewater's principles would be rank ordered in a hierarchy, from most to least important. The disagreement between Greg and Trina centered on two different principles, being open with critical opinions and encouraging others to be open with theirs. Both of these principles appeared in a list, without any information about which one mattered more. After studying values for more than 40 years, psychologist Shalom Schwartz has found that their main purpose is to help people choose between conflicting options. The relative importance of multiple values guides action, Schwartz explains. I pointed out to Dalio that when organizations fail to prioritize principles, their performance suffers. In a study of over 100 professional theaters by researchers Zanny Voss, Dan Cable, and Glenn Voss, leaders rated their importance of five values: artistic expression, innovative plays, entertainment, audience satisfaction, giving to the community, providing access, outreach, and education, achievement, being recognized for excellence, and financial performance, fiscal viability. The more strongly leaders disagreed about the importance of these values, the lower their ticket revenues and net income. It didn't matter what their principles were, as long as leaders established consensus about their significance. I added that establishing relative importance is especially essential when organizations have a large number of principles. In a study of over 150 hospitals led by Wharton professor Drew Carton, a compelling vision was necessary but not sufficient for strong health and financial performance. The more core principles a hospital emphasized, the less a vivid vision helped. When hospitals had more than four core values, a clear mission no longer offered any benefits for reducing heart attack readmission rates or increasing return on assets. The more principles you have, the greater the odds that employees focus on different values or interpret the same values differently. If that proved to be an issue with 5 to 10 principles, wouldn't it be an even greater problem with 200 or more? I agree with you, Dalio said. I can see that I might not have been clear enough that there's a hierarchy, because these 200 are not all the same. A principle is just some type of event happening over and over again, and how to deal with that event. Life consists of billions of these events. And if you can go from those billions to 250, you can make the connection. Ah, this is one of those. A light bulb went off for me. We have lots of categories to describe people's personalities, but few frameworks for describing the personalities of situations. Now I saw the value of having a large number of these principles, but I still wanted to know which ones mattered most. A few years earlier, Dalio had been asked whether it was his personal dream to have everyone live by the principles. No, 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 absolutely not, no, just please, no, he replied emphatically. That's not my dream. The number one principle is that you must think for yourself. The independent search for truth stood at the very top of the principle hierarchy. But I wanted to see Dalio go further in ranking the rest of the principles. Was it more important for leaders to share their critical opinions openly, or self-censor when there was a risk of discouraging more junior employees from speaking up? I need to be clearer about that, Dalio acknowledged. I worried that I offended him, but he broke out into a grin. Is that all you've got? He asked. Is that the best you can do? My other piece of feedback was tougher to deliver, because it got to the very heart of the idea meritocracy, which holds that people should fight for right and seek the truth. But Bridgewater's methods of adjudicating which idea wins fall short of my own standards of rigor. Dalio's default approach to resolving problems like the disagreement between Greg and Trina is to unearth three believable people with strong opinions from each side and have them discuss and debate until they're in sync. Yet this leaves decisions up to subjective opinions, which are notoriously flawed as a form of evidence. Believability takes into account test results, performance reviews, and other assessments. But a major component is the judgments of others. As one Bridgewater employee described it to me, you gain believability by other believable people saying you're believable. In the centuries since the Roman Catholic Church assigned the promotor fidei to argue against the advocatus dei, humanity has developed a tool more powerful than debate for resolving disagreement. It's called science. In the field of medicine, I told Dalio, there's widespread consensus among experts that the quality of evidence can be classified on a scale of strength from 1 to 6. The gold standard is a series of randomized, controlled experiments with objective outcomes. The least rigorous evidence, the opinion of respected authorities or expert committees. The same standards are part of the growing field of evidence-based management and people analytics, in which leaders are encouraged to design experiments and gather data, instead of relying solely on logic, experience, intuition, and conversation. If I were running Bridgewater, I would have resolved Greg and Trina's debate by running some small experiments. In various meetings, people would be randomly assigned to speak up. In some cases, leaders would criticize the speaker's delivery, as Greg had with Ashley. In other cases, they would affirm the speaker's courage, as Trina wanted Greg to do. And the rest of the time, they would do both or neither. I would then track how frequently and boldly the attendees voiced their concerns in subsequent meetings. This might be tough to execute, but at minimum, I would measure whether the people who saw Greg criticize Ashley, or reacted negatively to it, were speaking up less. This time, Dalio disagreed. I might be wrong, he qualified, but he explained that he favored the debate format between believable people, because it was the fastest way to reach the right answer, and it enabled them to learn from each other's reasoning. He had been testing out different cultural practices at Bridgewater for years, and although they're not controlled experiments, he felt he'd seen enough to have a good sense of what works. He believes that thoughtful disagreement between experts creates an efficient marketplace of ideas, where the best ones emerge over time. Here we agreed to disagree. Dalio places more faith than I do in the triangulated opinions of experts. For me, a critical test would be assigning some units to rely on believability-weighted debate and others to run experiments, and see which units make better decisions. Then every unit would try the opposite method and analyze the results again. As a social scientist, my bet is that, on average, groups that make decisions based on experiments will outperform those guided by debate between experts. But only the data will tell. Movers and Shapers. To his credit, Dalio has been running an investigation of his own. Fascinated with understanding people who shape the world and eager to discern what they have in common, he's been interviewing many of the most influential originals of our time and studying historical figures, from Benjamin Franklin to Albert Einstein to Steve Jobs. Of course, all of them were driven and imaginative, but I was intrigued by three other qualities on Dalio's list. Shapers are independent thinkers, curious, nonconforming, and rebellious. They practice brutal, non-hierarchical honesty, and they act in the face of risk because their fear of not succeeding exceeds their fear of failing. Dalio himself fits this description, and the hurdle facing him now is to find another shaper to fill his shoes. If he doesn't, Bridgewater may vanish like Polaroid's instant pictures. But Dalio knows that preventing groupthink is about more than the vision of a single leader. The greatest shapers don't stop at introducing originality into the world. They create cultures that unleash originality in others. Chapter 8. Rocking the Boat and Keeping It Steady. Managing Anxiety, Apathy, Ambivalence, and Anger. I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear. Nelson Mandela. In 2007, a lawyer named Lewis Pugh plunged into the Arctic Sea wearing only a Speedo, a swim cap, and goggles. The ice had melted to the point that it was no longer frozen solid, and his plan was to become the first person ever to survive a long-distance swim across the North Pole. Hailing from England and South Africa, Pugh had served in the British Special Air Service and worked as a maritime lawyer before becoming the best cold-water swimmer on the planet. 2 years earlier, he had broken a world record for the northernmost long-distance swim in frigid seas. Later that same year, he broke the southernmost record by leaping off an iceberg to swim a full kilometer in Antarctica. Pugh, who has been called a human polar bear, is capable of a feat that has never been documented in another human. Before a swim, his core body temperature elevates from 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit to 101 degrees Fahrenheit. His sports scientist coined a term for it, anticipatory thermogenesis, and it appears to be the fruit of decades of Pavlovian conditioning. When it's time to plunge into frosty waters, his body automatically prepares. Pugh calls it the art of self-heating. But unlike many world-class athletes, he does not consider it his mission simply to be the best in the world or to prove what's possible. He is an ocean advocate, an environmentalist who swims to raise awareness about climate change. The passengers on the Titanic perished in 41 degrees Fahrenheit water. In Pugh's Antarctic swim, the water temperature was at the freshwater freezing point of 32 degrees Fahrenheit. At the North Pole, he was facing something even more lethal, less than 29 degrees Fahrenheit. After falling into that water, a British explorer had lost fingers due to frostbite in only 3 minutes. Pugh's team estimated that his swim would require almost 20. 2 days before the big effort, Pugh took a dip for a 5-minute practice swim, and afterward he couldn't feel his entire left hand or any of the fingers on his right, and he wouldn't again for 4 more months. The cells in his fingers burst, and he was hyperventilating. Instead of visualizing success, Pugh began to imagine failure. "Great depths don't normally hold any fear for me, but this is different," he thought. If he failed, he would die, and his body would sink more than 2.5 miles to the bottom of the Arctic. Paralyzed by fear, he began to question whether he could survive. Would he have been better off envisioning the best-case scenario? This chapter examines the emotional drama involved in going against the grain. In my own research at a healthcare company, I tested how much employees knew about effective strategies for managing emotions, comparing their responses to expert ratings on how best to handle emotionally challenging situations, like being demoted from a job, being nervous before a major presentation, getting blamed for a mistake, and having teammates turn in shoddy work. Those who aced the emotion regulation test spoke up more often with ideas and suggestions to challenge the status quo, and their managers rated them as more effective in doing so. They marshaled the courage to rock the boat and mastered the techniques for keeping it steady. To understand these skills, I'll consider how Pugh heated up to brave icy waters, and Martin Luther King Jr. prepared civil rights activists to keep their cool. I'll also explore how a group of activists overthrew a dictator, and a technology leader convinced engineers to make a radical change to their product. By studying effective strategies for managing emotions, you'll discover when it's best to plan like an optimist or a pessimist, whether calming yourself down can fight fear and venting can quench anger, and what it takes to maintain your resolve when the odds are against you. The positive power of negative thinking. Although many originals come across as beacons of conviction and confidence on the outside, their inner experiences are peppered with ambivalence and self-doubt. When outstanding U.S. government leaders described their most difficult decisions, they reported struggling not with complex problems, but with choices that required courage. And new research led by Rice professor Scott Sonnenschein indicates that even the most dedicated environmentalists wrestle with constant uncertainty about whether they can succeed in their mission. Choosing to challenge the status quo is an uphill battle, and there are bound to be failures, barriers, and setbacks along the way. Psychologist Julie Norum studies 2 different strategies for handling these challenges: strategic optimism and defensive pessimism. Strategic optimists anticipate the best, staying calm and setting high expectations. Defensive pessimists expect the worst, feeling anxious and imagining all the things that can go wrong. If you're a defensive pessimist, about a week before a big speech, you convince yourself that you're doomed to fail. And it won't be just ordinary failure. You'll trip on stage and then forget all your lines. Most people assume it's better to be a strategic optimist than a defensive pessimist. Yet Norum finds that although defensive pessimists are more anxious and less confident in analytical, verbal, and creative tasks, they perform just as well as strategic optimists. At first, I asked how these people were able to do so well despite their pessimism, Norum writes. Before long, I began to realize that they were doing so well because of their pessimism. In one experiment, Norum and a colleague asked people to throw darts after being randomly assigned to picture a perfect performance, envision a bad performance, or relax. Defensive pessimists were about 30% more accurate in their dart throws when they thought about negative outcomes, rather than imagining positive outcomes or relaxing. In another experiment, on a tracing task that demanded focus and accuracy. Defensive pessimists were 29% more accurate when they were not encouraged than when they were told they would probably do very well. Those same words of encouragement boosted the performance of strategic optimists by 14%. And in preparing a mental math test that required adding and subtracting in their heads, calculations like 23 minus 68 plus 51, defensive pessimists scored about 25% higher when they made a list of the worst things that could happen in the test and how they would feel than when they distracted themselves. Defensive pessimism is a strategy used in specific situations to manage anxiety, fear, and worry, Norum explains. When self-doubts creep in, defensive pessimists don't allow themselves to be crippled by fear. They deliberately imagine a disaster scenario to intensify their anxiety and convert it into motivation. Once they've considered the worst, they're driven to avoid it, considering every relevant detail to make sure they don't crash and burn, which enables them to feel a sense of control. Their anxiety reaches its zenith before the event, so that when it arrives, they're ready to succeed. Their confidence springs not from ignorance or delusions about the difficulties ahead, but from a realistic appraisal and an exhaustive plan. When they don't feel anxious, they become complacent. When encouraged, they become discouraged from planning. If you want to sabotage the performance of chronic, defensive pessimists, just make them happy. Lewis Pugh was usually an optimist. He saw possibilities where others wouldn't, and persevered when others would give up. But in the weeks before major swims, he often operated like a defensive pessimist. Much of his inspiration came not from the high expectations of his own team, but from the discouragement of doubters. 2 years earlier, when gearing up for his record-breaking northern swim, he had been fueled by an outdoorsman telling him it was impossible and he would die. Before another big swim, he reminded himself of skeptics and imagined them gloating to their friends that he couldn't achieve it. Being the first to undertake a swim is exponentially harder than going second. You don't know what will happen. The fear can be crippling, he writes. As Pugh stood shaking at the North Pole, his instincts warned him of the calamity that was about to unfold. But instead of trying to cheer up, he found that his negative thinking shows where things can go wrong, and it gets rid of complacency. Considering the worst-case scenario impelled him to prepare thoroughly and mitigate against every single possible risk. Research shows that when American presidents' inaugural addresses feature positive thoughts about the future, employment rates and gross domestic product decline during their terms in office. When presidents are too optimistic, the economy gets worse. Negative thoughts can direct our attention to potential problems, and the absence of those thoughts predicts a failure to take preventative and corrective actions. He started formulating plans to spend less time on the ice before the swim and return to the boat immediately afterward. The trick is to make fear your friend, he notes. Fear forces you to prepare more rigorously and see potential problems more quickly. That was an important step, but it wasn't enough to keep him going. As you'll see, defensive pessimism is a valuable resource when commitment to the task is steadfast. But when commitment flutters, anxiety and doubt can backfire. Don't stop believing. When ordinary people list their fears, one tends to be more common than death: public speaking. As Jerry Seinfeld jokes, if you have to go to a funeral, you're better off in the casket than doing the eulogy. If we want to understand how to manage fear, we don't have to threaten people's lives. We need only threaten to put them on stage. Allison Wood Brooks, a professor at Harvard Business School, asked college students to deliver a persuasive speech on why they would make good collaborators at work. A critical experimenter sat in the audience, and all the speeches were videotaped. A committee of peers would be enlisted later to evaluate each speaker's persuasiveness and confidence. With only 2 minutes to prepare, many of the students were visibly shaking. If you were in this situation, how would you manage your fear? When Brooks asked 300 working Americans to offer advice on this matter, the most popular recommendation was, try to relax and calm down. This is the most obvious suggestion, favored by more than 90% of professionals, yet it isn't the best one. Before the college students gave their speeches, Brooks asked them to speak 3 words out loud. She randomly assigned them to say either, I am calm, or I am excited. That one word, calm versus excited, was sufficient to significantly alter the quality of their speeches. When students labeled their emotions as excitement, their speeches were rated as 17% more persuasive and 15% more confident than those of students who branded themselves calm. Reframing fear as excitement also motivated the speakers, boosting the average length of their speeches by 29%. They had the courage to spend an extra 37 seconds on stage. In another experiment, when students were nervous before taking a tough math test, they scored 22% better if they were told, try to get excited instead of try to remain calm. But is reframing fear as excitement the best way to cope with nerves? To find out whether it's better to just acknowledge anxiety, Brooks gave students another frightening task. She asked them to sing 80s rock music in public. Standing in front of a group of peers, students belted out the Journey song, Don't Stop Believin', into a microphone. A voice recognition program on the Nintendo Wii automatically scored their performance on an accuracy scale from 0 to 100%, assessing volume, pitch, and note duration. They would earn a bonus for high scores. Before they started singing, she randomly assigned the students to say, I am anxious, or I am excited. A control group, who said nothing prior to performing, averaged an accuracy score of 69%. Labeling the emotion as anxiety reduced accuracy to 53%. Instead of helping them accept fear, it reinforced that they were afraid. Calling it excitement was enough to spike accuracy to 80%. To overcome fear, why does getting excited work better than trying to calm yourself down? Fear is an intense emotion. You can feel your heart pumping and your blood coursing. In that state, trying to relax is like slamming on the brakes when a car is going 80 miles per hour. The vehicle still has momentum. Rather than trying to suppress a strong emotion, it's easier to convert it into a different emotion. One that's equally intense, but propels us to step on the gas. Physiologically, we have a stop system and a go system. Your stop system slows you down and makes you cautious and vigilant, explains Quiet author Susan Cain. Your go system revs you up and makes you excited. Instead of hitting the stop switch, we can motivate ourselves to act in the face of fear by pressing the go switch. Fear is marked by uncertainty about the future. We're worried that something bad will happen. But because the event hasn't occurred yet, there's also a possibility, however slim, that the outcome will be positive. We can step on the gas by focusing on the reasons to move forward, the sliver of excitement that we feel about breaking loose and singing our song. When we're not yet committed to a particular action, thinking like a defensive pessimist can be hazardous. Since we don't have our hearts set on charging ahead, envisioning a dismal failure will only activate anxiety, triggering the stop system and slamming our brakes. By looking on the bright side, we'll activate enthusiasm and turn on the go system. But once we've settled on a course of action, when anxieties creep in, it's better to think like a defensive pessimist and confront them directly. In this case, instead of attempting to turn worries and doubts into positive emotions, we can shift the go system into higher gear by embracing our fear. Since we've set our minds to press forward, envisioning the worst-case scenario enables us to harness anxiety as a source of motivation to prepare and succeed. Neuroscience research suggests that when we're anxious, the unknown is more terrifying than the negative. As Julie Norum describes it, once people have imagined the worst, they feel more in control. In some sense, they've peaked in anxiety before their actual performance. By the time they get to the event itself, they've taken care of almost everything. In every previous cold water swim, Lewis Pugh had the unshakable conviction that he could succeed, so the defensive pessimist strategy was effective. Analyzing the potential hazards left him as prepared as possible. At the North Pole, that approach worked initially, but after the disastrous test swim, my belief system was splintered. If 5 minutes in this water had caused so much pain and damage to my hands, what would 20 minutes do? He couldn't shake the fear that the swim could be deadly. What I felt on that stupid test swim wasn't like anything I'd felt before. I don't believe I can do this. With his commitment wavering, it was time to shift away from defensive pessimism and activate the go system by focusing on the reasons to do the swim. A friend gave him 3 ideas to get excited. First, they would plant national flags at key markers along the way to remind Pugh of the 29 people from 10 countries who helped make the swim possible. In earlier swims, Pugh had been motivated by those who doubted you. But now, his friend said, he should focus on those people who believe in you, who have inspired you. Second, he should look back and remember how his parents inspired him to care about protecting the environment. And third, he should look ahead and think of the legacy he could establish to fight climate change. After listening to him, the idea of abandoning the swim disappeared, Pugh reflects. He dove into the frigid water and started swimming against the current. 18 minutes and 50 seconds later, he successfully finished and sustained no physical damage. 3 years after that, he swam across the highest lake on Mount Everest. Whereas Pugh's biggest hurdle was regulating his own fear, many originals have to manage other people's emotions. When others are afraid to act, how can we activate their go systems? In the summer of 2009, 15 young tourists made a pilgrimage to Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. After walking them around the city's square, the tour guide, a lanky Serbian in his mid-30s, regaled them with stories about the country's recent history of inflated potato prices, free rock concerts, and wars with neighboring countries. But as the guide sprinkled his comments about Serbia with references to Monty Python humor and Tolkien fantasies, the tourists grew impatient. They weren't just an ordinary group of travelers. They had come to Belgrade to learn how to overthrow their own country's dictator. Searching for a way to fight back against a tyrant, they asked the tour guide about how his countrymen had defeated the Serbian dictator, Slobodan Milosevic. You don't need to take big risks, the guide told them. You can demonstrate your resistance in small ways. Drive slower than usual. Throw ping pong balls onto the streets. Or put food coloring in fountains to make the water look different. The foreigners scoffed at his advice. Such trivial actions wouldn't make a dent in an iron curtain. It can never happen in our country, a man insisted. If we stand up to him, a woman challenged, our dictator will simply make us vanish. How can we even plan a revolution when he has made it illegal to gather in groups of more than 3? They didn't know it, but the tour guide had heard all these objections before. He heard them in 2003 from Georgian activists. In 2004, from Ukrainian activists. In 2005, from Lebanese activists. And in 2008, from Maldivian activists. In each case, they overcame fear and apathy and took down their respective dictators. The tour guide, Serge Popovic, had trained them all. Popovic was one of the masterminds behind Otpor, the grassroots youth nonviolence movement that overthrew Milosevic. A decade earlier, he had suffered through ethnic cleansing and martial law, and gaped in horror as his mother's building was bombed. He was arrested, jailed, and beaten. His life flashed before his eyes when an officer of the law jammed a pistol into his mouth. When psychologist Dan McAdams and his colleagues asked adults to tell their life stories and plotted their emotional trajectories over time, they discovered two different desirable patterns. Some people had consistently pleasant experiences. They were content throughout the major periods of their lives. The people who had been recognized for making original contributions to their communities shared many more stories that started negatively but surged upward. They struggled early and triumphed only later. Despite being confronted with more negative events, they reported greater satisfaction with their lives and a stronger sense of purpose. Instead of merely enjoying good fortune all along, they endured the battle of turning bad things good and judged it as a more rewarding route to a life well lived. Originality brings more bumps in the road, yet it leaves us with more happiness and a greater sense of meaning. Proper revolutions are not cataclysmic explosions, Popovic observes. They are long, controlled burns. After working with friends to lead the movement that toppled Milosevic and brought democracy to Serbia, Popovic dedicated his life to preparing activists to lead nonviolent revolutions. In 2010, the 15 foreigners he trained a year earlier used his methods to overthrow the Egyptian dictator. Not every group has succeeded, but we can learn a lot from Popovic's approaches to conquering fear, overcoming apathy, and channeling anger. His first step mirrors how a technology leader dealt with fear among his employees. Outsourcing inspiration. When Josh Silverman took the reins of Skype in February 2008, the company was facing significant challenges. Employee morale was plummeting as the company was failing to maintain the explosive growth that Skype had experienced after pioneering free computer-to-computer calls and cheap long-distance calls between phones and computers. Silverman decided to make a big bet on an original feature, full-screen video calls. In April, he announced a moonshot goal to release Skype 4.0 with the video feature by the end of the year. The emotion among many employees was passionately negative. A lot of people thought it was too big a change and we were going to kill the company, Silverman recalls. They worried that the timeline was too short, video quality would be poor, and users would hate a full-screen format. Instead of trying to calm them down, Silverman decided to psych them up by developing a Skype vision that would get them inspired about video. At a series of all-hands meetings, he emphasized the impact of the product on people's lives, articulating a vision that he later formalized during a conversation with actor and technology investor Ashton Kutcher. It's not about making cheap phone calls. It's about being together when you're not in the same room. When originals come up with a vision for transforming anxiety into excitement, they usually take it upon themselves to communicate it. But just because it's your idea doesn't mean you're the best person to activate the go system. In a series of experiments, Dave Hoffman and I found that the most inspiring way to convey a vision is to outsource it to the people who are actually affected by it. Consider university fundraisers, who are often extremely nervous about calling alumni, interrupting their dinners, and asking them to donate money. When two leaders spoke passionately to them about how the money they were being asked to solicit would make a difference, the callers didn't become any more effective. The amount of money the average caller raised more than tripled, however, when leaders outsourced inspiration to a scholarship student, who described how the caller's efforts had enabled him to afford university tuition and study abroad in China. On average, callers went from raising under $2,500 in the 2 weeks before the student spoke to over $9,700 in the 2 weeks after. They were suspicious of the leaders, who clearly had the ulterior motive of convincing them to work harder. When the same message came from a scholarship student, they found it more authentic, honest, and truthful. They empathized with the student, and instead of being anxious about asking for money, they were excited to solicit donations to help more students like him. We wanted to prove that even when the message was held constant, it would be more effective when it was delivered by a beneficiary than by a leader. So in our next experiment, we asked people to edit a paper by an international graduate student that contained many minor grammatical errors. We explained that it was for a program that existed to help these students improve their papers so that they could obtain jobs. To provide an example of how the editing could make a difference, we randomly assigned participants to watch one of two versions of a video clip of the same woman speaking about a student who had received 3 job offers as a direct result of the program's editing help. She introduced herself as Priya Patel, either the director in charge of the program or the student who benefited from the program. Seeing the leader speak about the impact of the program didn't make a difference. On average, that group spotted fewer than 25 errors, the same as a control group who didn't see the video at all. But when she described herself as a student who benefited from the program, they caught an average of 33 errors, a boost of 34%. We also gave them a chance to write open-ended comments to the student and had independent coders rate how constructive and helpful they were. The comments were 21% better when they saw the beneficiary video than the leader video. This doesn't mean, though, that leaders need to step out of the picture altogether. In later studies, I found that people are inspired to achieve the highest performance when leaders describe a vision and then invite a customer to bring it to life with a personal story. The leader's message provides an overarching vision to start the car, and the user's story offers an emotional appeal that steps on the accelerator. At Skype, Josh Silverman knew the best way to activate the Go system wasn't through his words alone. After talking about how Skype enabled his own children to have a deep personal relationship with their grandparents, despite living 8 time zones apart, he breathed life into the vision by giving the floor to Skype users as a regular feature of his all-hands meeting. A married couple shared how they survived a year-long separation during their engagement only thanks to daily talks on Skype. A serviceman spoke about how Skype had allowed him to maintain a close relationship with his children while serving in Iraq. They even opened Christmas presents together. Bringing the customer into the room connected them to the mission and reached their hearts and minds, Silverman says. It helped employees see what a difference we could make in the world. As they grasped that Skype was about connecting people, the team's anxiety gave way to excitement. Inspired to build a video feature that would enable more meaningful conversations, they shipped Skype 4.0 on schedule with high-quality, full-screen video calls. Soon, Skype was adding about 380,000 users per day. By the end of the last quarter of the year, more than a third of the 36.1 billion computer-to-computer minutes spent on Skype were video calls. Less than 3 years after Silverman shared his vision and brought in users to inspire the team, Microsoft bought Skype were $8.5 billion, a 300% climb in value. In Serbia, Serja Popovic and his friends launched the Otpor Revolution by outsourcing inspiration. They knew that the words of a charismatic leader wouldn't suffice to overcome the terror inflicted by a violent dictator. Many qualified candidates were too afraid to put their lives on the line, and even if one could be found, Milosevic could squash the resistance by making that brave soul disappear. So instead of appointing a leader to activate the GO system, Popovic outsourced inspiration to a symbol, a black clenched fist. The effort began in the fall of 1998, when Popovic and his friends were college students. They spray-painted 300 clenched fists around the town square and plastered stickers of the image throughout buildings in Belgrade. Without that fist, he says, the revolution would never have happened. In the spring of 2010, a year after training the Egyptian activists, Popovic stopped cold in front of a newspaper stand. The clenched fist of Otpor was featured on a front page, pictured on a poster held by a woman under the headline, "The Fist Shakes Cairo." The Egyptian activists had chosen to galvanize their own GO systems by outsourcing inspiration to the same symbol. What made the fist so energizing? Strength in small numbers. In a classic experiment, psychologist Solomon Asch asked people to judge the lengths of different lines. Imagine that you're brought into a room with seven other people and are shown images of four vertical lines. Your task is to look at the line on the left and decide which other line, A, B, or C, is the same length. The correct answer is obviously B, and everyone in the group provides it. You all agree in the next round, too. Then comes the third trial. The right answer in that case is clearly C. But strangely, the first person in your group insists it's B. You're stunned when the second person picks B as well. The third and fourth group members call out B, too. What would you do? The other people in your group are confederates in cahoots with the research team. There are 18 trials in total, and the others have been instructed to intentionally give the wrong answer on 12 of them to determine if you'll go against your better judgment and follow the majority. Over a third of the time, participants conformed. They chose the line they knew didn't match just because the rest of the group did. Three-quarters of participants conformed at least once with a wrong answer. When they were tested alone, people virtually never erred. When they went along with the group, they knew they were giving an incorrect answer, but they were afraid of being ridiculed. It doesn't take a violent dictator to silence us through fear. Just flying solo with an opinion can make even a committed original fearful enough to conform to the majority. The easiest way to encourage nonconformity is to introduce a single dissenter. As entrepreneur Derek Sivers put it, the first follower is what transforms a lone nut into a leader. If you were sitting with seven other people and six group members picked the wrong answer, but the remaining one chose the correct answer, conformity dropped dramatically. Errors fell from 37% to just 5.5%. The presence of a supporting partner depleted the majority of much of its pressure, Asch wrote. Merely knowing that you're not the only resistor makes it substantially easier to reject the crowd. Emotional strength can be found even in small numbers. In the words of Margaret Mead, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. To feel that you're not alone, you don't need a whole crowd to join you. Research by Sigal Barsaid and Hakan Oshlik shows that in business and government organizations, just having one friend is enough to significantly decrease loneliness. If you want people to go out on a limb, you need to show them that they're not alone. That was the first key to the success of Otpor and a number of other revolutions.